rockers Run Westy Run take the stage with their signature mix of indie, punk, folk, and rock. Through many different iterations over the years, the Westy core of Craig Johnson, Kirk Johnson, and Terry Fisher remains intact. Opening the show are the Customers. More information about Run Westy Run at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
Programming on KFAI is sponsored by NDC and MEDA, administrators of DEED's Minnesota Promise Act. The Minnesota Promise Act provides grants and loans for underestimated businesses in specific neighborhoods of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Application details can be found at mnpromiseact.org. Support for KFAI comes from the Red Sea, presenting Space Cadets, Friday, September 26th. Space Cadets is a showcase cabaret of DJs and musicians, featuring live performances from Vanaka Nation, Tufu One, Jada Brown, and Isabella Lopez. Plus, DJs Chico Chi and Talia Knight will be spinning tunes all through the night. The Red Sea is located at 320 Cedar Avenue South in the Riverside neighborhood of Minneapolis.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Today, we're revisiting our chat with David Kanoyer, Rosebud Sioux tribal member and seasoned communications expert. We talk with David about his long career in journalism, storytelling, and nonprofit communications, and the key moments that led him to Minnesota. Please enjoy our conversation with David Kanoyer from June of 2024.
I have always seen the world through stories. Stories are how we get to know each other. They're how we entertain and how we engage. They're how we impart culture and lessons. And yeah, we all have the Google at our fingertips, but you gotta kind of go talk to people and smell, taste, try it out. I think stories really are the kickstarter to that process.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, educators, language warriors, you name it. They have a wonderful mix of passions, and we talk to them about those and their gifts and how they share their gifts with the community. And, finding the big point of purpose in our lives and at the same time, amplifying Native voices, of course. So, Leah, how are you doing today?
Doing well.
Yeah?
Enjoying life, enjoying the sun and the rain and the everything in between. How about you?
Doing great. Recovering from a cold, but, we're alive. We're ready to go. We're excited for the show.
Nice. Well, I got to say, we got our garden in.
Yeah.
We also planted a pollinator garden this year at the house. So I'm really excited about that. And we also put our old Halloween decorations to use. I have a zombie arm coming out of one of the planters.
Does that dissuade rabbits and such?
But it amuses me.
That's
so
awesome. I have a nice ant garden in the back, and it's not intentional, but I have to figure out a way to get rid of them. We'll see.
There you go. Your ant landlords.
Yeah.
Well, we also have a pair of woodchucks that are slowly destroying our yard, so we'll have to maneuver them elsewhere.
Yeah, I think we have like voles or something.
Ooh.
Every now and then you'll see like these little holes that are in the grass and sometimes where the ants are, and they probably get some good meals out of those ants, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. Home ownership.
Yep. One animal that likes to dig up our yard and do the little holes is a skunk.
Yes. I did see that. When I was looking up the types of holes you can get in your yard, and I did see skunk, but I don't know if we have skunk in this area, but you never know.
Could be eating those grubs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
More on that later. But I am really excited to share this conversation with you, Cole.
Yeah.
Our schedules are on and off with each other lately, but we still keep the program going, sharing Native voices. So I'm going to share with you...
So much is going on.
A guest.
Sorry.
Our latest and greatest guest, David Knoyer. David Knoyer is a citizen of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He lives in the Twin Cities, and he works in communications at ACES, the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. And he's been in storytelling for 3 decades. He's worked in nonprofit communications and journalism. And in David's bio, he says he believes stories can be the best way to connect people to each other and to new ideas. So it's a pretty great thinker, which you'll hear in our conversation. So,
all right, can't wait. Let's go.
Okay. Bonjour, David Knoyer. Thanks for joining me on Native Lights. Can you please take a moment and introduce yourself?
Well, hi, Leah. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I am a Knoyer in an Indian country. That means if you've been to South Dakota, you've probably heard of a Knoyer or two. My grandfather had a bunch of brothers, and so we're spread out all over the place. I'm enrolled at Rosebud. Both my parents are from there. They were high school sweethearts. And my father was in the Indian Health Service, and we moved around a lot. And I ended up in Florida, and I'm a father. I've got 2 daughters, young women. The youngest just graduated from college. So that felt really, really good. And I'm a recovering TV reporter. I'm a recovering foundation staff member. Philanthropy, private philanthropy. I work for ACES, which promotes Indigenous STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math education and careers in Minnesota. This will be 16 winters in a row, but last year didn't count, so maybe we should just say 15. And yeah, thank you. It's been great to know you. I've worked with your family, and my daughter is babysat for your child. So, hey, that's awesome when we have those personal relationships, right?
That's right. Yeah, those babysitters are so valuable, especially when I know Marvin was very little when he was babysat. So, oh, such a relief. How are you doing lately, and how is your family?
I was doing some yard work 3 weeks ago and was trying to dig out this weed that turns into this stalk, and the top of the stalk was, you know, whipping around with me trying to pull it up, and it whipped right in my eye. And I'd never had anything like that happen. I didn't have my glasses on, and my eye was just this red blob. It looked terrible. And thankfully the vision and the cornea wasn't hurt. It was okay, but geez, you know, quite a scare.
Yeah, I hear you. And well, and it's the season for yard work. Eye protection is very important. I like to kick off our conversations by asking if there's anything you're thinking about today that's like on the top of your mind. Like, for example, my kid has been bugging me today about Dungeons and Dragons. So anyway, is there anything that's on your mind lately?
You know, I'm in between trips, and the blessing of looking for stories and working for ACES actually is getting to go and look for stories of Indigenous science, people exploring and failing. You know, the faster you fail, the sooner you succeed, the whole scientific method. So telling these stories I love doing it. I've been a big fan of this program, and it's a mid-level dental provider called the Dental Therapists. Why they call it therapist, I don't know, because one of them joked that, well, people think that, you know, they're providing some sort of mental health counseling to people who had bad experiences at the dentist's office. And that's kind of what they do. These are community people who have a certain level of training that isn't 6 years at dental school. It's like 3 years condensed into 2. They're community people, and they can be nurse practitioner types for dentistry. So if you have a toothache, they can deal with it. They can deliver Novocaine. They can drill if they need to. They can fill. But basically, they're local people who want to work in the local dental clinic. They're not parachuting in to pay off, you know, college student loans and that kind of thing. And we know there aren't a lot of Native people providers, dentists, and and hygienists in the clinic to begin with. There aren't a lot. So this is a really cool model. And just hanging out with these folks, you know, was a lot of fun. You know, they're all revolutionaries, and it's a great story. So Google dental therapists and check out what the Swinomish tribe in Washington State is up to.
Wow, that's incredible. And so that brings us right into what your role is currently in communications for ACES, the American Indian Science and Engineering Society.
So I'm really trying to help ACES tell its story, but also the story of many, many people in the extended orbit of ACES who have their own stories, and they kind of relate to the same topic, but they're really, you know, those dental therapists, it's their story. You know, the people that have moved to Washington State from Michigan or other places, or Arizona, leaving their kids home because they couldn't afford to bring their kids to Washington State. So we know you make sacrifices for your education often, but to leave your, you know, your little ones home for that kind of extended time is crazy when you're a mom in particular, right? So trying to tell these stories and trying to help ACES focus on the stories and bring more people into the circle. Let's be excited about cultural fire. Let's be excited about putting these state-of-the-art sensors on a lake that produces wild rice so that we can see the temperature and the water depth and the wind and even the wake and the waves, right, from boats on that lake, because we know that climate change is impacting wild rice. So those types of stories are what I think get people to the fire, you know, bring people together. And then we have to work on making those connections.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMFERS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with David Knoyer, Rosebud Sioux tribal member and communications expert. Okay, I have this pitch, and I am not going to claim it. It came to me at some point, and I don't think I'll ever have time to do it, so anybody's free to take it over. But I would love to create a television series or a movie or a play, some sort of script where all the characters or the whole premise is society has decided to listen to Indigenous people. And what that future looks like if we listen to Indigenous values and wisdom and technologies. So just putting that out there.
I think that's one of the challenges is we know that this Indigenous knowledge, call it what you will, way of living, the good life that Ojibwe people talk about, right? All of the relationships between people and planet and nature, sustainability, we knew what it was, right? I saw this great quote of when the settlers arrived, they thought that the forests were doing their own thing with no stewardship or no management. These native people weren't doing anything to the land, right? So all that is bunk. Native people have been managing forests for generations in their own way. When you look at Google Maps and you look down at the Menominee Indian Reservation in Wisconsin, you can literally see this square reservation that pops out that's these verdant green forests. They've been cut down, but they've sustained them in their own way. And you can literally see the outlines of the reservation from outer space because of, right, the stewardship of the Menominee tribe. And talking to a soil scientist a couple weeks ago, she said the Zuni Pueblo have 16, 17, 18 different names for soil. The Pueblo, right? They have no water. That's crazy, right? But, you know, they're able to farm the land and make things grow there like the Hopi people, with hardly next to no water, and somehow they can get corn to come out of the rock dirt.
That's incredible. Yeah, totally. And so you started out in journalism. Can you tell me a little bit about how you became a journalist?
Like a lot of kids, sports was a big thing for me. My father was an Indian Health Service administrator, and he was loaned out in the 70s to go help start United Southeastern Tribes, which didn't exist. That's the Intertribal Alliance from Florida to Maine and over to New York. So Seminoles, Mississippi Choctaws, Eastern Band of Cherokee, Six Nations, the Maine tribes as well, state of Maine. And so we moved to Florida 1,800 miles from Rapid City, South Dakota. Baseball was a year-round thing there, so I just became a huge baseball fan and played constantly and wanted to be a sportscaster. In my high school, I was the PA announcer for the football games, some basketball, and I really wanted to be Bob Costas, you know. Sports ended up being kind of too routine and too kind of repetitive, and I'm like, I'll just do news, and that was better. So I had an internship with CBS News, which back then still, you know, was the big dog because there was no internet, there was no Facebook. Everybody was watching, you know, Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather. And so my first news job was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, making $7.26 an hour.
So you could get your fast food lunch and buy movie tickets.
I remember my parents were still paying my car insurance, you know, for sure.
Oh, my goodness. What did you like about reporting the news?
I like telling stories, and I like kind of really being in the know and being at the scene right before everybody else. I really enjoyed that, and I enjoyed the challenge of seeing something and then having to interpret it for other people, you know, in a very kind of real-time way. But I really loved the challenge of turning that around on a daily basis and having only so many hours to tell a really good story with what you got, the best building blocks that you have. The teamwork in that and the writing, right? The writing was really important. And then the people skills to try to get people to talk to you and tell them, you know, what they saw or help tell the story. Because I've always been somebody driven by quotes and people. I need the quote and I need the person's perspective in order to build the story around it. And then sometimes, you know, you just got to talk to 10 people and then you only get two quotes that are any good, right? But you still got to, you know, do it. So,
well, I like news and storytelling and journalism. I always loved school, just loved learning. I knew in college, I was like, if I could choose a career, it would be to be a professional college student my entire life. And what I find is storytelling, journalism, I feel like I get to go to school every day and learn something new and learn something so much that I can analyze, interpret, and synthesize it to help share it to an audience.
Yes.
And so I feel like I'm kind of a student learner, a little bit of a teacher with the assistance of the people being interviewed, all in one piece. So I find it really scratches that learning itch.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. So when I interned at CBS and I got to hang around some really, really, you know, veteran people, one of the things they talked about was you only might have a minute and a half to tell your story. And a minute and a half is 90 seconds. So what, 22 lines of copy for your minute and a half. But they said in order to distill something that concise, you need to know even more about the issue. And that's hard. It takes people and it takes some time and takes some analysis and it takes some experience to actually know what you're talking about. And you know, you don't have to be an expert, right? But you kind of need to know how to find the expert and how to ask the right questions of the expert. I didn't know anything at 25. I didn't know anything at 29 or 35, right? It really takes some folks who've been at it 20, 30 years. You know, when you think you're looking at the top of the iceberg, you need to be able to talk about more of what's under the surface that you can't see.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about career. I know you mentioned the scientific method when talking about ACES, and I wrote down fail to succeed. So how failure is an important part of eventual success. I've had to change my perspective on failure as a recovering perfectionist, that failure is evidence that I'm at least trying something. So if I fail something, I'm like, well, at least that means I tried something. You know, better luck next time.
Exactly.
Do you have some moments maybe that maybe pop out to you when you think of failing to succeed in your own career trajectory?
So one of the problems in journalism, right, is people are afraid to make mistakes. And so rather than being more transparent and asking people to help them get it right, they don't want to ask anybody. And so there's this sort of entitlement. And I guess, you know, just as a male in particular, I think I had a lot of that growing up where, you know, I was raised in a particular religious way. I was firstborn, straight and narrow type stuff, black and white, you know, looking at the world right and wrong, and didn't have a lot of grays and wasn't really taught about a lot of both ands. You know, it was more either or in my upbringing. I think that's a big deal with some people. It was certainly with me, and it took me a long time before I started to have more appreciation for that. And part of it is, you know, I think I know what I want. I think I know what I want to do, and not asking enough people for advice and really listening, and then being skeptical about some of the advice you get. I'm pretty happy with where I'm at, but of course you have questions, you know. At one point, I wanted to be a network news correspondent reporter. I gave that a shot, and CBS didn't know what to do with me because I wasn't dying to have my face on TV. I was happy just to be, you know, a producer behind the scenes. And so, you know, they ended up offering me a job at their Detroit station, you know, when I was about 30 years old. And Detroit just didn't sound like it was the right thing for me at the time, but that's what CBS News offered me. And, you know, if I really wanted to work at CBS, I couldn't say no. So I said no. I ended up working for Fox News when they first started their cable channel, before they had that real conservative bent. But that was a tough year because it was their first year on the air and we didn't have a lot of people. And I was in Colorado covering the Denver, Oklahoma City bombing trials, and JonBenet Ramsey, that little girl, was killed in her house. And those were huge stories that three or four of us were trying to cover. And that was just a long, miserable year. So, you know, then I went to nonprofits and went to go work for the American Indian College Fund, which really felt good. First time, you know, my media, my communications experience, and my personal tribal a background really came together, and it really felt right. You know, there's a tribal college on the Rosebud Reservation where I'm from, actually named after my great-great-great-grandfather type thing. And so education, as we know, is really important. Well, the Kellogg Foundation had a big project with the tribal colleges, and I ended up finding these stories for the foundation about what their investments were doing at the tribal colleges, which were still pretty small at the time and didn't have a huge communications capacity to tell their own story. They're just trying to do the work, as we know, right? There's so many cool stories in Indian country, but there's nobody whose job it is often to stay on top of them. And the people who are making news in Indian country are too busy making news, and no one's telling these stories, right? And it's by accident. So anyhow, Kellogg had an opening one day, and I'd done a pretty good job of finding those stories. And yeah, I'll move to Battle Creek, Michigan. You know, Michigan's kind of a tough place. We've got tribes there, but a lot of them have only been federally recognized in the last 30 years, and they're pretty small. And then you've got the Sault Ste. Marie Band in the UP. And, you know, so there's not a huge Native presence in Michigan. You know, I had a lot of people say, oh, Dave, you could be a foundation president. You know, you'd be a great foundation executive, da, 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 da. Here I'm like, what are you talking about, right? I'm like 33, 34, 35. Wasn't even something that occurred to me that really, right? But I didn't. That wasn't, I'm not, you're not talking to a foundation president right now. So, you know, I think life has got weird twists and turns. And I think my only advice to people is ask as much advice as you can get and be open to all that advice.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMFERS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with David Kanoyer, Rosebud Sioux tribal member and communications expert.
Yeah, I always wondered how you went from journalism to philanthropy. And then how did you get to the Twin Cities?
So being in TV news back in the day, right, you move. And so I started in Albuquerque. I went to West Palm Beach. I came to Minneapolis in the 90s at Care 11 for 2 winters, then to Denver, Fox News, So I was moving, and probably to this day, I would move every 3 years if it was left to my own devices. Well, then, you know, you get married and you have little Marvin and or little daughters as we had, and their mother was like, no, no more. And so we had to pick a place. I'd been to Minneapolis in the 90s and, you know, like the Indian community. And I knew there was enough here that when I got bored, there would be other things to do. It's not a bad place to live if you can get through winter. You know, if we had more winters like last year, right, this place would look like California.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. And then now, of course, back full circle in communications at ACES, telling these stories of Indigenous science, Indigenous brilliance. Is there something particular that motivates you to do the work you do now?
I think telling a great story is what I really enjoy. But it's not for me. It's you can tell, right, Leah? You can tell when you've done it right and you took extra time and went the extra mile to tell that story as authentically and as respectfully and in ways that honor the people involved. It's not always perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but you did the best job you could. And you know, just because you're Leah, you know, you're already right so far ahead of the, you know, you got such a head start on people for lots of good reasons that it's a gift that you gave them, right? It's this awesome gift that it's probably the first time in their life that some people have had their story told in such a beautiful, real way. And I think that feeling, it just gives you a lot of satisfaction. Even if you don't get feedback and a bunch of likes on Facebook or whatever, right? You just know that you know, right? You know.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned advice. So if you did have something to say to a person who is seeking to be a storyteller or journalist, what would you advise?
Well, first, I would say, you know, listen to Leah Lim's stories. Listen to as many stories as you can. Really pick them apart. And what did you like about them? Why did this connect with you? And what are some different ways to tell stories? I think it's essential. But TV has a lot of complexity. So I would say start with audio, start with radio. And you don't have to worry about all your pictures. But the storytelling is the same. And we don't have enough storytellers anywhere, native, non-native, none. We just don't have enough. And we don't have a lot of people that can write. So I would say start on writing and start on audio and radio and just tell some different types of stories, right? Try to tell that minute and a half story. You know, how do you take this issue and put it in 22, 23, capitalized 12-point font lines and tell that story? You know, the whole scientific method and failing involves research and involves data and involves feedback and evaluation. And that can sound like super, you know, oh, I'm going to put my white lab coat on and become an evaluator. But how does this connect to you? Or mom, let me tell you the story. What do you hear? Just asking them, what do they hear, right, is so important to what we're talking about. Because so many people don't ever ask that. And they put up their flyer or they write their story or they put their post up and they really have never gotten any feedback about it. And they might get a bunch of likes because it's some popular issue, but it wasn't told very well.
All right. That was David Knoyer, citizen of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, working in storytelling for quite a few years now. What'd you think, Cole?
His knowledge on science and astronomy and things like that. I'm glad, you know, to hear him, you know, taking that and sharing Indigenous knowledge when it comes to science.
Yep.
And I will also take his advice to heart when it comes to eye protection, getting out there on the yard, doing some weed whacking. Got to get those eyes covered up.
For sure.
So miigwech to our guest, David Knoyer. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lim. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine.
Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts.